Hi, I'm Susan Lewis. I sat down with Bob Rollins, author of Tunes of the 20s. I first asked him what prompted him to write this book.
Well, in 2010 and 11, I had a sabbatical, and I went to New Orleans. And the purpose of that was to compile a book of music for the Hal Leonard Corporation, which they called the Real Dixieland Book. It was 250 of the standard tunes in the traditional jazz repertoire. After I did that, I would play concerts and jobs, and people would say, well, I'm interested in your book. And I was disappointed to tell them, well, if you're not a musician, it won't do much good because it's just the tunes, it's sheet music with lyrics. And then I got the idea, because I would announce these tunes, and there would be stories to go along with them. I thought, well, what if I did that? What if I wrote a parallel companion volume, but instead of having the actual sheet music, it has stories about the songs?
And what is your instrument?
Usually clarinet in these venues. I play clarinet, saxophone, and flute.
I know there are other books on this general subject. I noticed you have an extensive bibliography, mm-hmm. and among them are Alec Wilder's American Popular Song.
Yes.
So how is your book different?
Well, all of those books seem to go in different directions. So there are reference books, which, of course, I needed them, books that had thorough, detailed, accurate information, but they weren't lively or engaging, nor were they meant to be. Then there's Wilder's book, which is written by a professional musician, and it's kind of musical. It assumes some knowledge of music. Mine does not. It's a reference book in the sense that the information is accurate, but what I did not do was have a parallel entry on each tune with the exact same information. Once I had the composer, lyricist, and the date of publication, then I would go on to significant recordings, and then there has to be some story about every song, and there always was. It could have been in the first recordings. It could have been in writing the song. It could be something peripheral to that. One of my favorite lines was Mrs. Gershwin, George Gershwin's mother, hearing a popular song by some other composer, said, "I wish my boys would write music like that."
One of the things I wondered was, in one section of your book, you talk about what jazz is, and you said in the 20s, there was confusion as to what jazz really meant.
Yes.
So as you approach this book, what does jazz mean to you?
I'm still confused myself, but certainly in the 20s, it referred to any kind of lively, peppy music. And the real change occurred in the years around 1917 and 1918, when what we would call the rhythm section came into place, where there's a drummer and there's a bass or tuba player and some kind of keyboard instrument or guitar. Prior to that, all bands were like little orchestras, and they really sounded like little operatic orchestras. James Reese Europe had a marvelous ragtime band in the teens. Vernon and Irene Castle had them as their house band. Well, anyway, the music's lovely, but it doesn't have the sound we expect because there's no rhythm section laying down the beat. And only when you have that do you have the syncopation, the cross rhythms that then have the sound that we've come to expect in not only jazz, but pop and all forms of 20th century popular music. When bands just had that feel, they were jazz bands. Paul Whiteman had a jazz band. Everybody thought it was a jazz band. He set out to form a jazz band. Well, he was a viola player. He couldn't play jazz the way we think of it, but the band played for dancing and they played the new rhythms.
It seems there are a couple of things the book does. It showcases the songs, obviously, which are arranged in alphabetical order. And there are a lot of firsts, like the first jazz piece to be written down, the first jazz recording, first solo improvisation. But also, each story gives you other information. It's as if the songs are revealing something else about the composers, both the famous composers and the kind of unsung heroes. As you found yourself going through this, did you find yourself surprised by anything or noticing any trends?
In a sense, I tried not to. I wanted to find what was unique about each song. And in a way, I felt a little bit like a jazz musician playing these songs. Okay, what can I do with this song tonight that I've never done before? And when I would get to a new song, okay, I don't want this entry to be like the last one or even a former one. What's special here? Where can I take this one? And it felt good, felt creative, and felt fun.
Do you make a distinction between songs written by jazz artists and songs written which become interpreted by jazz artists?
Well, in truth, usually songs written by jazz artists are not as expertly crafted as songs, if that makes any sense. A lot of Louis Armstrong's songs are great vehicles for him or for anybody, for any jazz artist. But usually, not always, but usually the melodies don't stand on their own, say, the way a Cole Porter or Gershwin melody would.
And maybe that's particularly true of this decade, this time period. This was before bebop and cool jazz.
Yes, it was. And, you know, sometimes that's the kind of song you want, like the riff tunes of the 1930s. There's not much to them. Sometimes just a repeated riff, because more than that would get in the way, would get in the way of the swing feel.
So you were guided by the songs. Did you deliberately set out to try to find songs that either stories behind songs that we know or songs that maybe we should know and don't? What was your goal?
Right. Again, the list goes back to the first publication. But even then, I had separate goals in mind. I wanted to have the standard tunes that everybody knew, but I wanted to have some tunes that nobody knew but maybe should, or maybe they'd enjoy knowing them. I mean, a tune like Alcoholic Blues, nobody does that. But when you look at the lyrics, they're just precious.
Can you tell me that story?
Well, the song was written in response to Prohibition. And the lyrics, which are really funny and goofy, need a little bit explanation. For example, there's the phrase, "When Mr. Hoover said to cut my dinner down, I never even hesitate, never frown." So yes, he's referring to Herbert Hoover here, but not as President Hoover, because he wouldn't occupy that office until 1929. He's actually referring to Hoover as Woodrow Wilson's appointed head of the U.S. Food Administration in the war effort. The slogan at the time was, "Food will win the war." So there are things like that embedded in lyrics that sometimes they need some explanation, and other times they're just goofy, like, "Whiskey, you used to make me frisky. So long, gin, when you coming back again?" And the wonderfully cringeworthy, "I've got the blues since they amputated my booze."
Are there certain composers that you also wanted to shed light on?
Sure. It's always fun to talk about Fats Waller, and it's always wonderful to hear a tune by Fats Waller. It was a guy who was larger than life. He had a heart larger than life, and his short life was pretty much unbelievable. And he wrote many fantastic tunes, and a lot of his compositions are not documented because he would sell them outright or not even bother to have some published. But he left us great standards like "Ain't Misbehavin'," "Crazy About My Baby," "Black and Blue," "Honeysuckle Rose."
As you found yourself going through this book, do any of these songs stand out as particularly significant to you personally as a musician?
Well, I have my favorites. Some songs are a lot of fun to play. There's a song called "Rosetta," and that had a story about it I had never heard before. That was written by Earl Hines, the great pianist who also led a big band. And in the 40s, he had people in his big band like Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, and he was a proponent of modern jazz. But he was around in the 20s. He was with Louis Armstrong on the Hot 7 recordings. Anyhow, he had a valet working for him who also became a fellow composer. They would write songs together. And the guy was negligent in making his appointments with Earl Hines. And he always was saying, "Oh, where is this guy? Oh, he's with Rosetta." "Well, who is this Rosetta?" "Well, that's his girlfriend." So one night, Earl Hines comped Rosetta to come for the evening with dinner and drinks just so he could see the girl. So Rosetta came, and they wrote a song for her called Rosetta. It's a wonderful little tune, and musicians like it because it's got a little harmonic twist up front that allows for some reharmonization, if you will. It's a flexible tune. You can do a lot with it, but it's a lot of fun to play.
What does knowing the stories How does that enhance your appreciation?
A lot of times it just corroborates what I always thought I knew about this music, is that it's great music written by great songwriters and recorded by great musicians who didn't take themselves seriously at all. I mean, they were just on the bandstand to frolic. You can hear that in Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives and Sevens, which, by the way, everyone considers the cornerstone of jazz improvisation. There's no more important group of recordings than those 90 or so sides he recorded between 1926 and 1929. But he's fooling around all the time. And they say what he did in the studio was just nothing compared to what he was doing nightly at the Sunset Cafe, where he had a steady job. So he was clowning around from day one. And sometimes hearing these stories or remembering what Louis did on his recording just kind of reminds me to lighten up and have some fun, because if you're not having fun with this music, it's not going to work.
So what do you hope readers will take away from this?
I hope they'll again fall in love with this decade, as many are. And you know what's really interesting? When you market something, the first thing is, well, who's your audience? And it's hard for me to get my mind around the fact that, well, it's people who are old enough to remember these tunes. Because remember, they were still around in the 50s and 60s. I mean, that what we called adult pop when I was young, well, they were just redoing the tunes from the 20s and 30s. That's what Sinatra and Dean Martin and Nat Cole and Judy Garland, those were the tunes they sang. So those people remember them. But the other thing happening is there is a real jazz age movement happening among young people in their 20s. Swing dancing is a large part of that, but also just the whole Roaring 20s themed image is appealing to people with their vintage clothing and Gatsby-themed parties and that sort of thing. I mean, face it, we've all been fascinated with the 1920s. That never in the history of the United States did society make such a quick left turn into something totally unexpected. You know, liberated women, and at the same time, you get Prohibition. What? How did that happen at the same time?
Great. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.